You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Hello, folks. It's Fran Barber here, and I'm here with Kylie Crabb. And it's the 13th week after Pentecost, or proper 16. And this episode we'll be talking about the Gospel reading, John 6, verses 56 to 69, and the Epistle, which is Ephesians 6, 10 to 20. So we might begin with John, Kylie. So a couple of weeks ago we had quite an in-depth conversation with Dorothy about John 6, and so of course we'll be revisiting some of those themes because they were pretty big. Yep. And life, cosmos and everything. We'll be revisiting those as they're expressed in this reading today. I'm really interested in lots of linguistic points in this passage, but starting with verse 56 on, what strikes you as a scholar that we should take note of?
Yeah, great questions. I think well, I mean, there's a few things that it's worth wondering about because of how they might sound to people who are in our congregations gathering with us. So one of them is that I noticed the stuff about the flesh is useless and the spirit gives life. Mm-hmm. Seems like a really fraught kind of verse that could really take us in unhelpful directions. So just thinking that through and thinking about how that sounds in the context of John's gospel, we're thinking about a gospel that's actually really quite earthy and grounded. Mm. You know, here, sure, it's like all kind of symbolic and in a way potentially kind of highfalutin kind of metaphor you could get carried away with, but we're really talking in a context where people were hungry and they had something to eat and that we're not, you know, overriding that. So we're thinking about the embodiment that is part of John's gospel and not kind of overriding some kind of weird Neoplatonism kind of distinction between bodies and flesh or minds and, you know, drawing some kind of saying something horrible about bodies.
No, because they're deeply incarnational, all of this. And the feeding of the 5,000, which began chapter 6, you know, they were hungry and they got fed here and now, not in some weird sort of
far off promised future
spiritual way or whatever. But yes, you know, so when it says the flesh is useless, is that? No, maybe I should have asked you before I pressed record here. But that strikes me that it sounds a bit like the Pauline use of flesh. That is, it's not about the physical body, but about a sort of human orientation towards things. That is limited and not godly.
As in the nature of flesh rather than, like we won't get in Paul, the difference between body and flesh.
Yes.
The language here is that it's of no benefit and so maybe there is a sense in which the embodiment is real. It's not just you know, it's not just matter, it's lived matter, maybe we might say. I'm not sure about the kind of distinction that we might get in Romans or something about between flesh and body, between sarx and soma. But definitely to just be really conscious that our authors are not just presuming the kind of distinction that becomes very popular in the centuries afterwards about dividing people up into bodies and spirits and minds and stuff like that, I think, yeah.
That it's the whole existence.
The whole thing, yeah. And I think, I mean, it's interesting to me too that when we get into the stuff about, you know, that this teaching is difficult, who can accept it, the language we're looking at there for accept it is the word for hear and listen. So there's this like this kind of broader meaning, I guess, to the word for listen, which is that, you know, to listen is to obey, is to live the thing. So there's all of that. If you're hearing it in the Greek, then all of that's in the word as you hear it. Right. Yeah.
So it's to listen and to bed down in oneself, not just hear words spoken or sounds made. Yeah, right.
That's sort of attend to or some kind of word like that. Yeah.
Probably we've gone past there, but we probably should point out, or people will notice it obviously, but the first few verses of the reading, they really are very confronting. Yes. Eat my flesh, drink my blood, and whoever eats me will live because of me. You know, just it's very fleshy.
Maybe other sayings that might sound really bizarre to people who walk in into worship off the street. It would have sounded pretty weird in the first century to outsider audiences, would
yes,
you say, Frank?
And yes, well, I think we did touch on that with Dorothy. I mean, also the sort of the Gnostic context of belief at the time, which would have found it quite appalling to be speaking in these terms. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's important kind of important to kind of notice that and not just kind of like smooth it over in this kind of like pseudo-Eucharistic kind of like symbolism kind of thing. Just think about like what does this mean? And then the word for, like abiding in, you know, the one where has it gone? The section about the one who that they abide in me and I in them. This prepares us for material later on in John's gospel about, you know, the vine and whatnot. In later on, I am the vine and abiding. So there's this sense of this quite moving sense of intimacy really within this and in the way that the eating works, the sort of mechanism that is presumed behind that and the idea of intimacy with Christ in this.
I noticed too, thinking of the whole passage, that we've had the crowds and they're murmuring and then we've gone down to, well, here we've got verse 60, when many of his disciples heard it, you know, so we start, this teaching is difficult. Which I do think that would be an interesting sermon title. The teaching is difficult.
It's kind of a warning for what comes.
Yeah,
next.
Yeah. Well, and you know, those of us who do find it difficult, we're not the first.
Yeah,
that's here.
Yes,
that's right. So we've got the disciples here, but then the group gets even smaller. Many of the disciples turn back in verse 66. And then we've just got the 12. So we've gone crowds, the disciples, and to the 12. And just, it's gradual rejection and misunderstanding.
Yes.
Yeah. Happening.
Yep. And people will remember, or if people didn't hear the podcast with Dorothy Lee a fortnight ago, this might be news to you, but this chapter is that whole sections of John are exploring different festivals and how they make sense in this kind of Christological lens of John's gospel. And in chapter 6, we've got this retelling of the Passover and the story of the Exodus with Moses. So here we've got this this thing with the grumbling. It's this grumbling word that we also get in Exodus, and that originally, you know, it's the Pharisees who grumble, and here it's the disciples, and they're kind of like Fran saying, they're like filtering down into a smaller and smaller group of grumblers who will turn back for something else, which, you know, like for the flesh pots of Egypt, like you get in Exodus.
And so when we see this gradual diminution of the group,
yeah,
we do, I think, need to see it, don't we, in the context of the universalism of John.
Yes.
That actually through Christ all are invited and all are embraced and all are represented. It's not a culling based on worth or...
Well, because there's another kind of challenging verse in here, right,
yes.
That it's about this, that is another one of these ones that, in fact, I think when we read this stuff out in church, we have to be really careful about how this sounds if you don't unpack it a bit. About coming to...
65. No one can come to me unless it is granted by the Father.
Yeah. Complicate. How would you engage with this verse yourself, Fran?
Well, I first would focus on the granted by words in that sentence, and which I understand as Greek, the Greek is given.
Like to give, yeah.
To give.
Yeah.
And this is a point I think I referred to in the conversation with Dorothy, because earlier in the chapter it's talks about drawn by. So God, you know, you are drawn by God, and the emphasis being that it's not about our own efforts or attempts to be good or to believe 12 impossible things before breakfast, but that through the power of the Spirit, God draws us in the mystery that is all of our encounters with grace. That is what brings us to God. Now, And maybe another thing you might say about how this might sound offendingly exclusive is that this is Jesus going to the Father. It's not a generalized theism or idea of God. This is not saying, well, here's this amorphous thing of God that our culture might talk about and Jesus is the only way to get to it. It's actually there's a specific relationship here to the God Jesus calls Abba. And so there is a specificity. There's a particularity which we get offended by, but it's in the context of the universal embrace.
Yeah, yeah. Just read out, it might sound like something really capricious. It's sort of like there's nothing you can do about it. You're either chosen or you're not, kind of thing. But the bigger context in John's gospel is that everybody is granted this, right? It's, you know, that when Jesus is lifted up, he will draw all things, all everyone to him. So it's not the backstory isn't like, oh, well, there's some kind of in or out thing going on.
Yeah. And, I mean, I might tie that conversation to the last verse, 69.
Yeah.
We've come to believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. And note that the word faith actually doesn't appear in John's gospel at all. It's believe. It's not even belief. It's believe. It's a verb. It's an action. And it's an open-ended thing that is open to the future and open to change. And as it says here, we've come to believe.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's gradual and it's really human. Fraught and flawed. And, you know, this line, Lord, to whom can we go? You have the words of eternal life.
Yeah.
Is that despairing or
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
We would go for something better, but this is what we're stuck with.
Yeah, you know.
No, but I think that there's I actually think that stuff is beautiful. Like it shows us, you know, like I'm saying, like for all the kind of high symbolism and stuff we might get in John and we think it's all kind of, you know, all very, fireworks or something. Yeah. And abstract, you know, like all that kind of stuff. You know, we also get these really earthy bits that are just kind of like humans being disciples. So you get the earlier call narrative is actually quite like right at the beginning in chapter one. It's like much more real. It's how you imagine it might happen. You know, like Philip runs into Jesus. Here's the story, blah, blah, blah. Philip goes and says to Nathaniel, oh, I found this thing, blah, blah, blah. You maybe want to find out about it. And it kind of builds up. And here we get this like really, you know, it's not just like, oh, well, you know, I shouldn't say this as like someone who often works on Luke Act, but it's not like a Damascus Road kind of thing where, you know, that Simon Peter here isn't saying, oh, I just got bowled over by, you know, a bright light and the truth of the vision, a vision of the risen Lord. This is, you know, I've come to believe this and to know.
And to know. The knowledge and belief.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Can you say anything about that?
I could say endless things about it, but I'm not sure how knowledgeable they are. But you know, like that, I think that is there's something to me, there is, but this is just thinking theologically, not necessarily about the text, but for me, there is an important kind of correlation there. And I don't know if people have had experiences like this, but when you've had like something kind of big happen that might have like rocked your faith and people ask you questions about this and say, you know, did it make you believe, did it change what you believed or something like that? The thing that I have found in my own life is that you can kind of absolutely terrible things happening can make you not believe anymore, and that's certainly some people's experience. But for me, it helped me to kind of know some things that I before had believed were true. And there's this kind of, you know, certainty that sort of, you know, like when you move to a new area and you don't know where anything is and you have to follow the streets to get, you know, you have to go, oh, I have to turn right at this place and then left at the next.
Think about everything.
Yeah, but and then after you've lived somewhere for a while, you've got an actual map of it in your mind, and you can take, if the street gets shut off or whatever, you can go a different way and get there. That feels to me like to begin with, you are like seeking things out and trying to learn them and saying, you know, that kind of I believe, help my unbelief kind of thing, which remains always part of our experience. And then we sometimes have these moments of I sort of know that this is the map that undergirds this.
Yeah, and that's a really helpful analogy and image, I think. And it made me think of the Psalms as well because, well, we're not talking about this particular Psalm today, but the history of human emotion and faith, you know.
Like we were talking with Howard last week.
That you see that dynamic moving through.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
So there's very many ways preachers could go with this text. But, yes, I think I'd want to tackle the sort of the universe. Well, I'd want to tackle what looks apparently very exclusive.
Yes.
And I'd want to talk about what I see to be the quite liberating understanding of belief that's coming through here.
Yeah.
And tied into that, the very sort of incarnational reality of all of life.
Yeah.
Because of the incarnation of Jesus.
Yeah. I think I would also want to wonder about how, I don't know how I would, if I directly address it, but just thinking about, you know, we do get this sense sometimes of like really dualistic kind of worldview that you get in John. Things are all dark and light. People are like totally wrong or right or whatnot. And you might see this, I mean, certainly in biblical scholarship, people have spent a lot of time hypothesizing about what the circumstances might have been in John's community and stuff and saying, you know, they're really sort of, they're ready to be combative and stuff. But I would also want to like invite us to not read into this kind of like us and them kind of thing or something, you know, and the way that the this teaching is difficult and then people start to kind of, you know, filter away. To not, I mean, there can be something quite tempting, right, in reading something like this in a quite sectarian kind of way, and saying, well, this is right, we're right, everybody else is wrong, and if people take offense at us, then that's because it's a hard word and they don't get what the truth is. And I don't know, I certainly sometimes come across people who seem to think that if you've offended people, that must mean you're preaching the good news.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes that is, you know, absolutely. And when we turn in a tick to to Ephesians, we'll get a sense of this as well. Sometimes, absolutely, the gospel is sort of has its offense. But just because you're annoying people doesn't mean you're preaching the good news.
No. Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find the link at our website, fatherwell.com.au.
Well, this seems like then a good moment, Kylie, move on to Ephesians 6:10-20. Some pretty full-on imagery in a totally different way in this reading, very militaristic. We perhaps should put it into some context. Do you want to do that a bit? Well, I mean, Martin helped us a bit with.
Yes, people will remember back to 3 weeks ago when we had Martin Wright here talking to us about Ephesians. And if you've been following it through, there's you've gone through all sorts of different bits and pieces on our way through in Ephesians and reinterpretations of some sections we get elsewhere in letters by Paul, with, you know, the imagery of the body. People remember Ephesians' reinterpretation of the body and Christ as the head. And we're into like the sort of latter bits of the letter now, where things in kind of standard letter format, not that you want to get overly stuck into this, but that things tend to move towards practical matters. Mm. And I would just say that, I mean, it doesn't mean that the rest of the letter isn't deeply practical. No, exactly. But here we are turning to that kind of thing.
Yes. So, I mean, as we've indicated, you could have read the John passage as quite an abstract thing that's not about day-to-day life. In fact, it is.
Yes.
It is very much about incarnational existence. And so is this passage in Ephesians, but in a different sort of way. So,
yeah. Well, so what stands out to you, Fran?
Well, just it's very, well, it's very militaristic, isn't it?
I mean,
the whole armour of God, the evil day. So I'm interested in the judgment that's alluded to here. And
who the battle partners are?
Who the battle partner is? Well, spiritual forces of evil. So again, this is all stuff you need to unpack.
Yeah.
In our congregations now, particularly, it's not language we naturally lean towards.
And just thinking about the kind of cosmology that people in the first century, when this was written and read, would have had about where they understand, you know, like spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places, that there's some kind of battle in the heavenly places going on while there's a battle on earth also going on. So, I think all that stuff could get.
I mean, it's quite, I mean, I've got, part of me says that's very realistic. I mean, in terms of the sort of evil we do see manifest in human relationships and in the world.
And structural, I mean, we're much more aware of structural evil, aren't we?
Yeah. And I suppose simplistic readings in the tradition have wanted to personalise that or make it other and away from and so on. So I'm always, when I'm preaching around this stuff, always trying to, well, preaching against that sort of idea.
Yeah. The thing that really strikes me in this, though, when, you know, you've got this stuff that's like, you know, getting fully cloaked ready for battle here, and then but then sort of like what the purpose of this battle is. It's not just about who the opponent is, but the, like, one of the things that I just love that that stands out to me is in verse 15 with the, as shoes for your feet, put on whatever will make you ready to proclaim the gospel of peace.
Birkenstocks or stilettos, whatever.
Anything that will get you there. So, I mean, which shows, I mean, I just think that there is this beautiful, I mean, it's a sort of irony, right, that's embedded in this text, that you're getting ready for battle. But the battle is to get yourself, however you can, ready to be able to proclaim a gospel of peace.
I'm struck, and this might just be non sequitur, we can edit out, but it just made me think of John the Baptist clothed as well. Very different imagery to the
not looking so much like a battle, looking more like a Nazarite. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. But I can see people being able to play with this in terms, especially if you've got young children in your congregation and you wanted, it's quite helpful, concrete things mentioned here that you could do.
Wonder about
and do drawings of. But I just was writing down, like, all those things that you are clothed in. It's truth and righteousness, the gospel of peace, as you pointed out, faith, salvation, the Spirit, the Word of God, prayer and supplication. Mm. What a fabulous array of resources.
Things to be surrounded by. And that it kind of leads into that you've got all this stuff around you that is, that is sort of presented sort of metaphorically with this kind of armour. But then, the point of it in verse 18, you get to pray in the Spirit at all times in every prayer and supplication. So, I mean, that's not just a piece of armour. That's like what you do when you're dressed in this way. You're ready for that. Yeah. That's it. I mean, one of the things, I don't know what this, and again, you might have thoughts on this, Fran, in terms of children and conversations with your own children and stuff as well on this, but one of the things that I wonder about, you know, we get this stuff about the militaristic language and stuff, is about whether we present things as battles or not. So on the one hand, people might say, well, you're not really overturning this, if you're not really overturning a kind of imperial kind of, you know, battle-y kind of world, if you're just continuing to use the categories. And I can totally appreciate that, actually. But I also wonder about this stuff, about maybe sometimes think, and the text is very clear that this isn't about, you know, a real going to war against your neighbour. Like, the text is very clear about, I think, you know, the possibility that we might experience things as battles. And I've heard, you know, like things where we might think, do you talk about scary things with kids or not? And then the reflection that actually sometimes the things that are going on for kids already are a bit scary, and this might give them some language to
think about it. What do you think? Yeah, definitely. And I do think, yes, it's militaristic, but, you know, this was the context of the time. The Romans were in charge, and, you know, if I was one who was about to do my military service,
yes,
this would be super inspiring and would really play into all the language that I knew from day to day and upend it all on its head, which is what the gospel's meant to do.
Yes, yeah.
But when you ask your question, I was thinking we are often in a battle. We've got an internal conversation all the time about whether we're good enough, are we doing enough. Yeah. So I think, you know, and that's all buys into the competitive context that capitalism, I'm contending really, you know, puts us into.
Is this structural stuff, you know, the things that are kind of beyond.
So yeah. I think it's fairly naive to say we're not – we have alternative competing voices telling us what is good and true about ourselves all the time, and this is something extremely different. And so therefore I'm saying if children yes, that is how children experience life with friends at school.
Yeah.
Am I liked? Why, you know, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, okay, maybe the word battle isn't super helpful, but the dynamic is similar, internal sort of
struggle
and where do I find my orientation and where can I sit in peace?
Yeah.
You know, that's, so I think we can explain it away a bit glibly as modern comfortable people sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and it definitely, I mean, I feel like at the moment as well, you know, we're coming to you from yet another lockdown in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And I know that people listening have been locked down for longer in other states and that people are having their other struggles all over the world at the moment. That, you know, like there is something honest as well about being able to name, you know, I was going to say name the demons. And I think, you know, like you can see how easily we can use that language symbolically of the stuff that we're up against in life.
Mm. I'm struck too in the last part, verse 18 onwards, persevere in supplication for all the saints. So just the whole context, the communal context of, and I mean, I read that as the dead and the living.
Yep.
That phrase. And then the injunction from Paul to pray also for me. So this section all about speaking and that the gospel is present when it is spoken.
Yes.
And that it is so powerful and transformative that he must pray that I declare it boldly. Mm. And this makes me think back to the John one about this teaching's difficult. There's something, you know, bold doesn't mean difficult, but it's pretty...
Yeah. Being compelled to speak. Yeah.
For I must speak.
Yeah.
I must declare this.
Yeah.
And so I see a sermon quite easily flowing from from that. But.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And also, I mean, I also think whether this is how we would I think, in fact, for people who are listening who are also in positions of leadership in churches, I think that Ephesians has heaps of stuff that is important and interesting for us to hear about the kind of the leadership dynamic in our churches. And people might remember from 3 weeks ago, whenever it was, that I had mentioned the section of the reading that was about equipping the saints and that this, you know, that part of... That part of what we're called to do, and the saints in that context being, you know, like equipping all the people around us in our Christian community to be able to live out their discipleship in whatever way. And I think that it connects here as well, this, you know, that there's this mutuality and really significant relationship between all the people in the community, so that even the person who is speaking as Paul here in this letter, like people remember we talked a little bit about authorship as well previously, but we'll call him Paul either way here because that's how the letter presents him. But, you know, that Paul here is asking the community to pray for him so that when he speaks, it may genuinely be this communication of the mystery of the gospel. So there's this interdependence here that we're...
It's a discernment of the community through the Spirit with the speaker.
Yeah, exactly. And that true leadership in this style will also be sustaining the other members of the community for their own living out of their discipleship at the same time.
I think that's a good note on which to finish. Thanks for listening, folks.
Thanks all.
By the Well has been recorded on Wurundjeri land. It's produced by Adrian Jackson and brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia.